Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The president wants American energy to go green. So does the public, by every opinion poll. But the Clipper wind power plant in Cedar Falls, Iowa, has laid off a quarter of its factory workers and slashed its wind turbine production by half. So have a lot of others, as global competition grows. Why? This hour, On Point, a case study in the headwinds for wind power in the USA and what it might take to go green. You can join the conversation. Can we have cheap oil, cheap gas, and a green energy future? Do you see green energy industry ramping up or stalling out now that oil's back down? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. President Obama talks plenty about green energy, wind power. On Earth Day, April 22nd, he visited a wind tower factory in Iowa and spoke out in support of wind power.
It's estimated that if we fully pursue our potential for wind energy on land and offshore, wind can generate as much as 20% of our electricity by 2030 and create a quarter million jobs in the process, 250,000 jobs in the process, jobs that pay well and provide good benefits.
The president, 20% of our energy from wind by 2030 and a big industry as well, he says. Just last week in Chicago at the big annual American Wind Energy Association conference, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar picked up the same theme.
The Department of the Interior is changing how we do business, and we will open our doors to wise, responsible, renewable energy production on our public lands and on our oceans.
So why do we have layoffs in wind power in Iowa? Later in this hour, we'll hear from Iowa Governor Chet Culver, who's just back from that big wind power conference in Chicago. But joining us first today from Dallas is Jeffrey Ball, environmental editor for the Wall Street Journal. His latest column was Alternative Energy's Fortune Shift with the Winds, looking at the story of Clipper wind power in Cedar Falls. Jeff Ball, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
So if wind is on a roll, why is this plant laying people off? Are they alone in that? Is wind power booming or busting, or what's going on?
No, the Clipper wind power factory is decidedly not alone. It's reflective, really, of the entire industry and as you say, headwinds that the industry is facing. I think the point is that wind had been on a roll, quite an extraordinary roll, for the past few years, and particularly for much of 2008. And then it fell off a cliff, essentially, when the credit crunch hit and the recession set in late 2008. And for all sorts of reasons that have to do with the very structure of the renewable energy industry, really owing to the fact that renewable energy companies tend relatively to be small and at this point in their development really capital intensive, that sudden drying up of finance walloped the renewable energy industry, and wind, of all the renewable energy sources, of all the sources that most people think of as renewable, is really the biggest industry. And so wind got hit particularly hard, and Iowa got hit particularly hard because Iowa has gone headlong into wind over the past few years, and Clipper, as a big plant in Iowa, got hit very hard, and as you say, was forced to make layoffs and dropped its production pretty significantly.
We'll hear from the governor of Iowa on that and from the chairman of Clipper Wind Power, but you've been to the plant in Cedar Falls. Paint a picture for us, Jeff. What do you see there? What are they making?
It's a fascinating place. Let's maybe start, Tom, by kind of keeping the lens a bit wide open, and then we'll come down to the plant.
Good.
If you take a look at a map of the United States, a wind map of the United States, that is a map of where the wind blows, and it's shaded according to the velocity of wind, the dark being fast, you see a dark alley stretching northward from Texas up through the Dakotas. It's essentially the wind alley of the United States.
Right up the middle.
Right up the middle. You'll also see very dark splotches on the coasts, and that's why you heard the Interior Secretary talk about offshore wind, because if there's a way that can be devised to cost-effectively harness offshore wind, there are huge potential resources. But for our purposes, let's talk about the middle of the country. Iowa sits right alongside that wind alley,
yep.
And so Iowa has two benefits. Iowa has a lot of wind, and second of all, Iowa has a manufacturing heritage. Mm-hmm. And Iowa has been hit hard, like much of the Rust Belt, by the decline in manufacturing jobs in the United States in recent years. And so, therefore, Iowa has a lot of idle manufacturing capacity. Along comes, for all sorts of reasons that we'll probably get into, a resurgence of interest in wind, and some of those factories now have been restarted as wind turbine factories. One of those factories...
When you say wind turbine, you mean the whole great thing, the tower, the blades, and the generator in the middle of it that turns out electricity?
Well, it varies. In the case of Clipper, Clipper is a company that's based in California that has a really fascinating history, and you'll hear, I'm sure, mm-hmm. from Jim Dielson about that history. But Clipper... designs the entire wind turbine. What it manufactures in this plant in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is not the entire turbine, but essentially the guts of the turbine. That is the gearbox, mm-hmm. the generators, the stuff that actually converts the movement of the wind into electricity. What it does not build in that plant is the tall tower, the shaft, and it also does not build the blades. The blades are built in Brazil, but all of those things are designed by Clipper.
Okay.
And so when you go to this factory, what you see is a sort of typical Rust Belt city that's been down on its luck lately, and that to a large degree is still somewhat down on its luck. However, this is sort of manna from heaven for Iowa and for Cedar Rapids, the arrival of the wind industry. And when I talk to a number of people who work or worked at the factory, you hear a similar story. These are people, many of whom worked for, say, Maytag mm-hmm. or old line appliance industry, mm-hmm. and they lost their jobs, and suddenly wind came along and re-employed them. They were retrained to build essentially a different kind of heavy metal, mm-hmm. and these people know how to build heavy metal. And things were going great guns. The factory opened in late 2006. Things were going great guns through 2007 and through much of 2008. Orders were shooting through the roof. Essentially, this factory could not build turbines fast enough. And this was actually a former printing press factory.
In Cedar Falls.
In Cedar Rapids, actually.
Rapids, excuse me.
And then what happened was the workers and executives at the company say, starting in late fall of 2008, dark clouds started to gather. It became clear that the people who buy Clipper's turbines, that is electric power utilities, wind power developers, those people were starting to see signs of a softening economy. Mm-hmm. And it also became clear that the people who supply Clipper, the people farther down, the companies farther down the supply chain, were having economic troubles as well. And then all of a sudden, in September, interestingly enough, Clipper named a new chief executive, someone who was not from the wind power industry but had a long history in manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the hiring of this sort of a CEO was really a sign that Clipper was poised to shift to a bigger structure. And then the next month, things, as I say, fell off a cliff, owing not to Clipper, really, but to the broader economy. And for the reasons that we talked about at the outset, the wind industry and Clipper really got hit hard. Now, Clipper's particularly interesting because Clipper and Jim Dielson are really behind the design of much of the U.S. wind power industry. Mm. And so the broader picture in Iowa, and you'll probably hear this from the governor, is that there are many wind power factories in Iowa. Many of them have been hit hard. Clipper is not the only wind turbine plant in Iowa, which has laid people off in recent months. Mm. But interestingly, some of those other plants are not U.S.-based companies. For reasons owing to policy in Europe, Europe has had a much more aggressive policy about incentivizing renewable energy. It's incubated very much more and now larger wind power companies, which have jumped the Atlantic and now set up shop in the United States.
Jeff, well, hold the thought right there, if you would. We'll dig into that. But I've got Jim Dielson with us, James Dielson, the founder and chairman of Clipper Wind Power. He joins us today from Santa Barbara, California. Mr. Dielson, thanks for being here.
Delighted.
So we got a little bit of the detail from your Cedar Rapids plant there. There's a bigger picture with Clipper Wind Power. But is this just a cyclical setback for your company, some layoffs, but you'll be back like gangbusters, bringing on that energy future President Obama is talking about? Or are you somehow facing a structural problem that could leave American industry falling short generally on wind power?
Well, we've been through some pretty decent setbacks over the years. And I think what we're seeing now is applause based on the economy. My sense is that there will be support for wind power from the administration, and we'll be up and running, within this next year. So it's one of those things that you just kind of grit your way through.
Iowa isn't the only state that has dreams of wind power resuscitating a lot of old factory facilities. Michigan and many more in that same line of thinking. Do you see that out there for the United States, or is it an open question depending on American policy, Jim?
Well, I think it is very much tied to policy, but the other factors that are kicking in now that we hadn't seen in the past is an awareness on climate and on global warming, and a general concern on peak oil. So these are motivating factors that I think will help policy move along, and certainly is something that's well understood by the public.
Jeff Bowie, just got 30 seconds before the break, but Jim seems confident that it'll come back. Do you see a long-term structural problem here, or just a momentary pause?
Well, I think that there's a great dichotomy between the short-term challenge and the long-term potential for renewable energy broadly and wind power more specifically. The short-term problem is really the economy, the global recession. Mm. The long-term looks pretty bright for renewable energy. As Jim said, there's increasing global concern about climate change and therefore about the burning of fossil fuels. The United States gets about half of its electricity from burning coal. And there are increasing interests in diversifying energy resources toward domestic resources. The problem for the industry is whether it can get beyond this bump.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about headwinds for wind power in the United States right now. The story of one company's uphill struggle to churn out alternative energy for American markets. My guests are Jeffrey Ball, environmental editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Dallas. From Santa Barbara, California, we're joined by James Dielson, founder and chairman of Clipper Wind Power, been working in the wind industry since 1980, has a big plant in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. They've been laying off employees, cutting back production, just and everybody's talking about ramping up. In just a couple of minutes, we'll hear from the governor of Iowa. He and a number of other Midwestern governors with the big wind conference in Chicago just last week. Chet Culver will join us. Here's T. Boone Pickens. He talks a lot about wind. He was at the Wind Power Conference in Chicago, saying here that Americans support a new push for renewable energy.
It's going to be teed up for this president to do the energy deal, because the American people want it. From the polling, you can see it, and when you got that many people that want something, it is going to happen.
Teed up, says T. Boone Pickens. Jim Dielson, the energy deal, what's he talking about? Do you need some kind of deal beyond just the markets to pull you on?
Well, historically, there's been on-again, off-again support for wind power in terms of tax credits. And some view that as a subsidy. Frankly, I see it as a way to levelize the playing field with carbon fuels, where you really aren't incorporating the full cost of the use of carbon fuels because of the emissions. In a way, it's like dumping toxics into a river. You know, now that's being accounted for, but with wind, it. And with renewable energy, there are subsidies that try to equalize for that effect.
We'll talk about how those might work, and we'll hear from the governor of Iowa in just a second. Let's get a call from, the town where you've got your plant, Jim, from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. We have Curtis on the line. Hi, Curtis. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
Real brief, I just wanted to say I had a family member who worked in that previous plant, and it used to be called Rockwell Goss. And they made, there was a union shop, and they made printing presses.
This is where Clipper Wind Power is now, Curtis?
Correct, sir.
Okay.
$60,000 to $80,000 a year down there in them shops working. Mm-hmm. Now they make about $15 an hour. And the truth going forward is if the environmental piece is that important, we have to understand, you know, that to create good jobs, to compete with some of these folks and get our best players in there, we got to keep the salaries up around batting averages, at least where they were previously. And I'll let you answer. I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Curtis, for calling. Jim Dilson, there's a call right from Cedar Rapids about the plant, what it did, what it does now. And you hear Curtis. He says, great, but it doesn't pay like the union jobs did there before. What do you say?
Well, it's a young industry that really is struggling on marginal economics, and it's I don't think unlike any relatively new industry where you have efficiencies to build in and volumes to build in production, and with that comes greater margins. But it's been a pretty lean industry for pretty much as long as I've been in.
I mean, Curtis is talking maybe 30,000 instead of 60 or 80,000. That's a big drop down. Do you see that heading up if the industry survives and thrives?
Well, if you look at Europe as an example, Europe has had good support for renewable energy and for wind. And there you have very competitive salary levels. So I think it's one of these things where you just have to get the right policies in place to be able to make the industry viable.
Let's hear from the governor of Iowa about what those policies might be. Joining us right now from Des Moines, Democratic Governor of Iowa Chet Culver is here. He's been outspoken in his support of wind power. Governor Culver, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Good to be with you and Jim.
How important do you see wind power to Iowa's economic and energy future?
Well, very important. Fortunately, we have become one of the national leaders in wind energy. We now rank second in the nation in wind generation. We're number one, certainly at the very top in terms of leading the way with manufacturing jobs per capita that are related to the wind industry, thanks to companies like Clipper and others that have decided to build their plants here in Iowa. Enormous potential. Within a 600-mile radius of Des Moines, there are $20 billion worth of wind farm projects. So we're right in the epicenter of the wind belt, if you will, and we have a very talented and capable workforce. We've always been a manufacturing state. So the opportunities are unlimited, but what we really need at this point is the federal government to step up. We need Congress to pass a renewable electricity standard. The RES is being debated in Washington as we speak, and that would really set the bar high across the country. The problem now is that only about half of the states have a renewable electric standard. So Iowa, we've had one for more than 20 years.
What does that mean, Governor, a renewable electricity standard?
It means that the states would be required to produce a certain amount of their electricity from renewable sources, whether that is ultimately 10% or 15%. That's what they're debating in Washington. But the problem is Iowa will now, the good news in Iowa, will produce as much as 15% of our power from renewable sources in 2009, but a neighboring state like Illinois that's never had a renewable electricity standard is producing very little.
So it's a kind of a quota for green energy.
That's right. The idea is that the country decides that we are going to be committed to renewable energy, and therefore we're going to have at least a minimum standard that we require as a country that we're going to produce from renewable sources. And then that'll encourage then and give incentives to states like Illinois and others that haven't put a lot into renewable energy to help us as a country meet this new standard.
If you don't get that, what happens to the future of this as an industry in Iowa and elsewhere? Is it viable just in market terms? Does it have to have a floor put under it by the government?
Well, it'll continue to be viable, but it'll just make it harder. And that's why we appreciate the leadership of President Obama. He has done more for renewable energy in the last 5 months than any president ever, literally. He has gotten a fantastic team in place at the Department of Energy and at EPA, and he's pushing every day. He's talking a lot about renewable energy. In fact, he was here in Newton, Iowa on Earth Day,
right.
Speaking about the opportunities that renewable energy presents for our country, especially when it comes to creating millions of green-collar jobs. So we've made real progress in a short period of time, and I hope with his leadership in the coming weeks we can get that renewable electricity standard passed in Washington.
Jeff Ball, you're down in Dallas. T. Boone Pickens, Terry, when he talks about the energy deal, it's going to get done. Is he talking about renewable electricity standards nationally? And do you see that coming? How's it look on Capitol Hill?
Well, what Boone Pickens is talking about is sort of the whole kit and caboodle. Really briefly, what Boone Pickens wants is to shift electricity production from natural gas, which currently provides about 20% of U.S. electricity, largely to wind. In his mind, that would free up natural gas that we're currently using for electricity to power generally trucks mm-hmm. in fleets. And that, in turn, would reduce a large amount of our need for imported oil. That's Boone Pickens' plan. And the broader answer to your question is that Boone Pickens and most people who envision a rapid ramp up for wind envision, as the governor just said and as Jim said, a combination of mandates and subsidies. The mandates of the moment are the renewable energy standard, which as Jim said, is a requirement mm-hmm. that utilities produce a certain chunk of their electricity from renewable power. And the subsidies are a whole raft of tax incentives, both of which have been in place in Europe for years, which is why Europe, which is generally a less windy place than the United States, emerged early on as a wind power leader. And so you can quibble with whether subsidies and mandates are the right policy, the wrong policy, but the history suggests that one effect of subsidies and mandates is indeed to expand renewable energy.
Jim Dielson, are you going to be there for Governor Culver and Iowa if you don't have mandates and subsidies backing you up? Can you do it just straight up on the market, or have you been down that path already?
No, it'd be very very tough to make the industry work without any support. Perhaps there's a few niches where there's extraordinarily high winds or possibly higher prices for electricity needed, but as a general market, it just doesn't work.
Governor, let me take a call from Omaha, Nebraska here, not so far from you. Laverne is on the air. Hi, Laverne.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
You guys said $40 a barrel. Winning the oil endgame, sponsored by the Department of Defense, suggests that at $15 a barrel, it's profitable to do energy efficiency and renewables. And there's a whole report that was sponsored in 2003. And another thing you guys are leaving out is small-scale wind. Southwest Wind Power's wind turbines that go on the peak of your roof.
Yep.
And, of course, and George Bush Sr. has one of those in his backyard up at Kennebunkport, Maine. So, you're not discussing small-scale, you're not discussing efficiency, and it's true that at $15 a barrel, all of this becomes profitable, according to Amory Lovins, Rocky Mountain Institute, and the Department of Defense.
Hey, let's pick it up. Governor Culver, how about it? I mean, we saw $40 oil in a bunch of February. It's back to 57 now. That's a long way from 140-plus of last year. How much rides on the oil price, Governor? If it gets down, again, magically to $15 a barrel, Can this still happen? And does it have to happen on the big scale kind of turbines that Jim Dielson makes? Or what about little ones on our housetop?
Well, I think the caller makes a number of good points. He's right. No matter what happens with the price of oil, we can still make incredible gains in terms of energy efficiency and renewable energy. That doesn't mean we have to stop, for example, the research and development on things like cellulosic ethanol and biomass. One way or the other, our country needs to wean ourselves off of our dependence on imported energy, imported oil, and whether that ultimately means that it's wind will be the primary option or biomass or some other type of alternative energy, today we don't know. So that's why in Iowa we're focusing on a very diversified renewable energy portfolio. We have a $100 million Iowa Power Fund, for example, so we're researching in second and third generation renewable energy technologies. We're doing algae research. We're doing solar. We're doing wind. We're doing biofuels, biomass. So the caller makes a good point. I'm not worried about the price of oil. I know that it's going to go up. It's going to go up. We have no control over it. It's too expensive. It makes no sense to import the amount of oil that we're importing today. That's a horrible policy. I think all Americans can agree on that. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to get off of that dependence? I think wind is a fantastic option. The caller is right. We have enormous opportunity with smaller scale wind turbines. In fact, in Mount Air, Iowa, we have a company that's going to be producing smaller wind turbines. 70% of our state could benefit from some form of wind generation. But we have to do the large scale wind projects and wind farms before and get that stabilized before we can expect to go into areas that don't generate as much wind. But I, at the same time, it'd be nice to do as much as we can. And so I'm a proponent of helping those smaller communities and even individuals put up a smaller wind turbine if we can make that financially viable too.
Governor Chet Culver of Iowa, humping there for green energy. Governor Culver, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. And I would ask your callers to call their members of Congress and encourage them to pass the renewable electricity standard as soon as possible.
There's the appeal from Des Moines. Thank you, Governor Culver. Jim Dielson, the governor, says he's not worried about the price of oil. You've been on this merry-go-round for a while. Are you? Can you ride it out if it goes up or down?
Well, it does have a very very direct impact with in the United States. It's really natural gas that Wind Power competes against, and as oil goes down, natural gas goes down, and so the price of electricity goes down, and that's a source of revenue for wind projects. So we do need to be able to have some kind of support to be able to make it through the times when oil does go down and gas goes down. And what's needed really is just a permanent kind of policy that gets us away from this cyclical up and down that we've been through really for the last 20 years of wind power. What it's done is to really drive the industry to Europe with a discontinuity in energy policy and with tax credits, which historically have gone for a couple of years and then expired. It's just been a real death blow to the industry as it just starts to get rolling, and then the tax credits expire, and then then they get renewed again. It's a very difficult way to build a business.
Jim, I see that you're listed on the London Stock Exchange. So are you an American company now or a British company? What are you, Clipper?
Well, when we got to the point of starting production on the Liberty Turbine in Iowa, we needed financing, and at that point, the U.S. markets really weren't much attuned to renewable energy. So the only way we could get financing was to go to the London Stock Exchange, and that actually has worked out quite well. But we're a U.S.-based company.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about headwinds for wind power in the U.S., the story of one company's struggle to churn out alternative energy for American markets. Clipper Wind Power has a manufacturing facility in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's a complicated story, but the heart of it is right now oil is down, and so is their employment and their production. James Dielson's been in the business for a long time. He joins us today from Santa Barbara, California. Been working in wind and wind turbines since 1980. Jeff Ball is with us. He's environmental editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Been writing about the Cedar Rapids plant and a lot more. Let's get a call from Northborough, Massachusetts. And Barbara, hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for accepting my call.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about future value being mischaracterized as present value. With example, the Cape Wind project in Massachusetts, the beleaguered project.
Off of Cape Cod, very controversial, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, for 7 years now. Minerals Management Service has come back with their final environmental impact statement, stating that the project is not economically viable. That's echoed by U.S. EPA. Now, at the same time, the new administration wants to promote offshore wind energy. The GE 3.6 megawatt wind turbine is discontinued. We're hearing from Vestas chiefs that the project would create energy at twice the current price of energy, and the ancillary costs associated, for example, transmission that the Department of Energy states is required, would also increase, for example, up to 6.8 gigawatts for Massachusetts ISO New England, another $3.9 billion expense for taxpayers and ratepayers.
For transmission of this power.
Yes, mm-hmm. And it's required for wind specifically. So when we're looking at a capital cost of a project like Cape Wind at about $2 billion that Beacon Hill Institute states is creates a subsidy need of about 77% of the construction cost, we also look at twice the price of energy, the 77% subsidy, then beyond that, the transmission cost of $3.9 billion. Then beyond that, operation and maintenance, which is for the cost of operation about one-third of a wind farm.
And you're adding it all up and saying, does this really and truly make sense? Barbara, let us pick that up, and I thank you for your call. And Jeff Ball, Jim Gilson, let me team that, if I may. Barbara's looking at wind power, wind production off of Cape Cod. We've got an email here or a message on the website from West Central Texas, from PW, also skeptical. He says, you know, he's been enthusiastically in favor of harnessing wind energy, but he's beginning to see real problems with it as well. Real damage done to wildlife, he says, the unpleasant fact of wind power transmission lines all across the landscape. He says, so wind power isn't free of problems. What began as an enthusiasm for him is quickly becoming a burden. Jim Dielson, let me come first to you. There's a couple of angles of skepticism from Massachusetts and Texas. What do you say to those?
Well, what you have with wind is a fairly high capital cost going in, but then your energy's free. So when you look at wind projects, you really have to have a long-term perspective. And back a year ago, as people were facing $4 gas. It all started to come together and in their minds that I think now with energy prices down that's a little bit lost. The UK, for example, is now has a program for offshore wind for 25 gigawatts, which is actually more than we have in the U.S. at this point total, and that is planned for 2020.
Now, I can't follow the lingo. 25 gigawatts, is that what?
That's 25,000 megawatts of wind energy from offshore wind.
And that's more than the U.S. produces in all wind energy now, are you saying, or something?
That's more than we have totally installed to date.
Uh-huh.
What you're saying is that the European markets have a much keener sense of the environmental threat and their energy dependency with natural gas coming from Russia into the UK has been considered much more tenuous, and so I think they've placed a higher priority on going for offshore wind.
Makes it more vivid. Mm.
It does, and offshore wind in the U.S. Will be, I think, viable. It'll probably be 4, 5, 6 years from now, but it's certainly on the horizon.
I want to get you on the costs that our caller outlined, Jeff, but let me get a call first here from Buffalo, New York. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm concerned that the young lady that called up about the Massachusetts project encountered all of the costs that would be encountered if we should go further with this project.
Mm-hmm.
What she left out was the cost to the planet if we remain tied to fossil fuels, be it coal or any other, and the other fact that we have neglected to actually produce an energy policy since the United States was even created. So to start quibbling now about what it's going to cost to save the planet and or to produce the kind of energy independence that's been kicked around for another 1,000 years, forget it. We're going to run out of oil. We don't have it. Then we can't have people sitting on the expressways trying to get into major metropolitan areas wasting fuel, which is, a reasonably infinite amount of fuel if you happen to have a lifetime as your time window. Mm. But if you're looking at the entire planet and or the country, we need to get off fossil fuel and use it for something useful like pharmaceuticals or plastics or whatever it is that we can get out of it. But
Michael, we've got it loud and clear, and I thank you for that call. Jeff Ball, there's a couple of back-to-back different perspectives. One focused on costs of wind power and all the attendants around that, and then Michael says, wait a minute, what about the cost of sticking with fossil fuels? How do you put those on the scales, Jeff?
Well, I think one premise that we all ought to start out with here is an admission that there is no free lunch. There is no magic bullet here, and no solution is perfect. Everyone has costs. Everyone has some advantages and some disadvantages. We have in this country and in this world an energy system based predominantly on fossil fuels, which is an entrenched energy system that's extremely convenient. And as a result of having grown up over decades, that energy system is, in the way we count things, relatively cheap. The reason we're here talking about this is that there are increasing concerns about the greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels and about energy security, that is the reliance of essentially industrialized countries on imports of oil from places that have a lot of oil and other fossil fuels. Everyone agrees. Most people agree who have studied this that the cheapest way to address this problem is through energy efficiency, as one of your callers mentioned before. Mm-hmm. That is to figure out how to burn fossil fuel in a way that gets more work out of each bit that we burn. There are difficulties in doing that, but most people who have studied it say that that is cheaper than renewable energy. However, most people also say that alone will not cut it in the sense of reducing emissions to the extent that scientists are saying ought to be reduced. And that brings us to renewable energy. And indeed, renewable energy is more expensive now than fossil fuel is. Jim, you heard Jim Dielson say essentially that the wind energy industry cannot thrive at the kinds of numbers that, for instance, Barack Obama is talking about without subsidies. And everywhere around the world that you look, that wind energy or solar energy or biofuels have thrived, it's been largely because they've been incubated by subsidies. Now, you can quibble with that, but the reality is that introducing a new technology costs more than sticking with the existing technology, and it is going to be a matter of a policy decision for this country and this world as to whether we think that's worth paying for or not, and there is a huge debate over that and will continue to be a huge debate over that.
Do people believe that policies are in place now that would produce the 20% of American energy from wind power by 2030 that we
no.
have Barack No, straight
no,
up.
No. Let's just throw out one other fact here. Wind power currently produces about 1% mm-hmm. of electricity in the U.S. and essentially about the same amount in the world. Barack Obama and the wind industry are talking about a goal of about 20% in a bit more than 20 years.
That's a huge bump.
That's a huge jump. It's perhaps a realistic goal, perhaps not a realistic goal, but clearly it depends on policy. And one other point I think that's worth making is that the conversation so far has talked about the extent of subsidies, that is how much money we, the taxpayers, ultimately would pay for this. And clearly, just like any special interest, the renewable energy industry would like to have as much of a subsidy as possible. However, I think that what the industry is talking fundamentally about is consistency, that is lack of volatility. In other words, if the industry gets less of a subsidy than it would prefer, what it wants is an expectation that it knows what it's going to face out over the years, so that there's some certainty in terms of investment in renewable mm-hmm. energy infrastructure. Because this industry, like the auto industry, like the oil industry, like any large energy related industry, has huge capital planning periods. And so, if you have a subsidy situation as we have had in the United States, where you have subsidies 1 year or 2 years, and then they go away, and then maybe they come back in a few years, That boom-bust cycle interrupts the investment of capital, even apart from the recession which we're facing now. And what it does is it makes it very difficult for engineers and scientists mm-hmm. to do what they do best, which is to figure out how to iterate technology and reduce the cost. And ultimately, If they can reduce the cost over time, the grand goal is to make these sorts of energy economically viable without subsidies. They're not there yet. One of the reasons that they're not there yet is that there's not been a consistency of policy to bring them down the cost curve.
Let's go to Frank in Bluffton, South Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is about alternative energy, and what it boils down to is if the corporations can figure out a way to get some money out of the wind or get some money out of the sun. What I use for a case in point is about 25 years ago in Australia, they sponsored a race of solar-powered cars. Mm. In 6 months, GM cobbled together a solar-powered car that could pass a tractor-trailer at speed. Needless to say, it won the race. The next car limped in like 6 or 8 hours behind it. So technology's there. It's just, you know, they haven't figured out how to make it profitable for them.
So should the government step in, Frank, to help structure the playing field so that they can be viable and get past the big cost up front and have a long-term future? Or should we just let the market decide?
Well, the market would decide if they could figure out, like I said, how to get money out of the wind, how to get money out of the sun. Seeing as they can't do that, the government necessarily does have to play a role in mandating that, you know, a certain percentage of alternative energy is going to be used for our needs. Otherwise, I mean, this stuff's finite. It's running out.
Yeah, and there's the question right now with these renewable energy standards of whether the government will do that. Frank, thank you. Let me get one here from Sutton, Vermont. Rob, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a couple of comments. First, there is no evidence anywhere in the world that wind power will reduce emissions or save the world from global warming. In Europe, no other plants have been shut down as a result of all the wind turbines they put up there. Another thing I'd like to
say... You mean it would just be additional energy? It wouldn't reduce the actual emissions, you're saying?
Right. It needs to be backed up with some sort of baseload power, and there's no history, no evidence, no proof of any savings of emissions. As a matter of fact, it's the other way around.
Okay.
Also, without the subsidies, tax credits, and accelerated depreciation, no one would be building these turbines. And one of the reasons they're not getting the investment is because investors don't want to invest in it for the same reason. And Clipper, in particular, is probably facing problems because their entire 2007 production had to be recalled for gearbox problems, taken down and returned to the factory at Clipper's expense.
That's a lot of work.
They also had to do the same with all their turbines in Iowa and Minnesota for 2007, and now they're having problems with their blades.
Rob, we've got it. Let me take it to Jim Dielson. Jeff Ball reports the same. I mean, it's no secret, Jim Dielson. Your 2000 production had some problems with cracks in some of the blades and turbine gear teeth wearing prematurely. Is this a technology we can count on, or is it still sort of bleeding edge? Be careful.
Well, we introduced a new machine that's 2.5 megawatts. It's a very large machine. At the time we introduced it, it was the largest in the U.S. And it, like every other machine that we've developed, goes through its teething problems. And our interest as a company is to respond very quickly when we see something that needs to be remediated. We take care of it. So I don't think this is any different than any other turbine manufacturer with an early stage introduction of a machine.
And Rob, our time is short here, but what about the suggestion from our caller that it doesn't really supplant fossil fuels? You know, those will go on with their emissions. And we've got other folks online and calling in asking, well, if we do subsidize, how can we be sure that this goes to build American industry and not end up somehow subsidizing foreign manufacturers and foreign profits with taxpayer money? Jeff?
I'm not sure. Are you asking me that question?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, the caller is right that wind power, when it's built, generally needs to be backed up by baseload power. Baseload is a fancy term in our current situation for fossil fuel power, and that's because the wind doesn't blow all the time.
Yep.
I mean, the goal is that if a renewable energy system were built as an adjunct, and again, let's be clear here, I don't think many people are talking about replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy.
20% of American energy, Obama says. That's
the goal,
a lot.
The goal is to ramp up renewable energy to a point where it's a significant chunk of additional power. Mm-hmm. But people are not talking about shutting down coal or gas, at least most people. But if that could happen at a greater, if you could get enough renewable energy, and then perhaps renewable energy itself could provide some backup that would obviate the need for that kind of baseload support.
Some kind of offset. And we're going to have to save the question on the nationality of companies that get saved for another day. In a global economy, that's always something when taxpayer money gets involved that people keep an eye on. But this has been a really interesting sort of window into this world, and we're grateful to both of you for helping us look through it. James Dielson, founder and chairman of Clipper Wind Power, joining us today from Santa Barbara. Thank you very much, Mr. Dielson.
You're welcome.
And Jeffrey Ball with The Wall Street Journal. Jeff, great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.